United States versus Groves. Mr. Barron.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. The principal issue before the court in this case is whether the district court erred in denying a motion to suppress evidence filed by appellant Devon Groves. That evidence was a handgun he was later convicted of possessing at trial, and a handgun that was obtained during a warrantless investigatory stop. We believe the district court erred and that the court should have actually granted the motion to suppress for two principal reasons. First, because Officer Slager stopped Groves in reliance on a police report that Groves was wanted on an outstanding arrest warrant. Under United States versus Hensley, the government was required to prove that the officer who issued that report had reasonable suspicion to stop Groves. It's our contention that the government did not present that evidence. In fact, no warrant ever even existed for Groves' arrest. The only basis for Groves' stop that the government established through evidence at the suppression hearing was an anonymous tip that Groves possibly had a gun. The Supreme Court's decision in Florida v. JL, however, makes clear that that tip wasn't sufficient to establish reasonable suspicion, precisely because the tip essentially just provided a description of Groves' appearance and location and offered no predictive information from which the police could determine the credibility of the anonymous tipster.
Well, the government doesn't even argue that the anonymous tip provided reasonable suspicion.
Correct.
So, I mean, Florida versus JL would foreclose.
Yes, I'll direct my argument to that point accordingly. What happened in this case is a dispatch was transmitted both through radio and computer communication to Officer Slager stating that Devon Groves is wanted on an outstanding arrest warrant. He's at this location. Stop him. Officer Slager, based on that information, stopped Groves, found a handgun. The problem that we're getting at here, Your Honors, is that there never was an arrest warrant, and the government didn't present the evidence that would have been required under Hensley to show that, to establish, A, who was responsible for issuing this false warrant report, where did it come from, and B, whether that amounted to reasonable suspicion.
Well, the problem is, it seems, that the defense submitted proposed findings to the judge conceding that the June 1st dispatch based on the May 1st bulletin. And so in doing so, hasn't the defense waived any argument about the lack of evidence?
Well, I think that's the principal argument of the government's brief, that there was waiver here. We disagree that there is waiver. We think that what is a full reading of the proceedings shows, and including the objections that you're referring to show, is that the Groves attorneys below consistently maintained that the basis for Groves' stop was this false warrant report, that we don't know what the warrant, that there was no evidentiary basis for the report.
Right.
And there's
But what you need is, what about those proposed findings? You know, the concession.
I don't think that there's a concession. If you reading the proposed findings, and I'll point out that this is described in the reply brief at page 5, the proposed findings that the government cites includes an ellipsis that pulls out two critical sentences from the two separate findings that were proposed. What was proposed was Officer Slager's stop was based on the dispatch. And the dispatch he received, he was not informed that he was doing an arrest on a crime information bulletin. He was unable to testify whether he was even present when the crime information bulletin might have been read. His arrest of Groves was based on his belief that Groves had an outstanding arrest warrant. And it goes on to say that, what these proposed findings acknowledge is, yes, there's a May bulletin. They don't acknowledge specifically that bulletin was the basis for the false warrant report that Officer Slager relied on. And in fact, the only way you can get there is through an inference that I don't think the government established through evidence at the suppression hearing. Specifically, you know, the government, the crux of the government's argument is essentially this. a bulletin was issued on May 1st, a full month prior to Grove's arrest. A dispatcher, therefore, must have looked at this bulletin, mistook it for indicating the existence of an arrest warrant, and based on that mistake, transmitted this false warrant report to Officer Slager. The problem with that is there are many problems with that. First of all, there's no testimony from the dispatcher explaining, you know, what his transmission to Officer Slager was based on. We don't know if the dispatcher ever even saw the May bulletin. I mean, the argument is also, we think, somewhat implausible. If you look at the bulletin itself, it doesn't say anything about an arrest warrant. It simply says, if you locate Devon Groves, please contact Corporal Johnson. It's difficult to understand how a trained dispatcher could look at an innocuous bulletin like that and determine it's stating there's an outstanding arrest warrant. And I'll point out as well that the district court made absolutely no factual findings with respect to the May bulletin, so I don't think that it accepted the premise that the May bulletin was the basis for the report. Rather, what the district court determined was that since Officer Slager subjectively believed there was a warrant, without any mention of where that warrant might have come from or that report of a warrant might have come from, that was enough to justify this stop.
Warren, would you turn to the argument on the good faith exception?
Yeah. The good faith exception here we think is inapplicable, and that's because it's indisputable that the conduct of law enforcement personnel led to the issuance of the false warrant report. So this case is fundamentally different.
Is that misconduct, you think? You think there's evidence that the dispatcher's involved in misconduct?
Well, I think that we can't really, we don't know precisely what conduct.
So we should attribute misconduct as opposed to.
I don't think you have to attribute misconduct. I think since it's the government's burden to establish that the good faith exception applies, they have to show that whatever conduct led to the unlawful arrest was the unlawful stop was something that falls under the good faith exception. And I'll point out that the Supreme Court has never applied the good faith exception in the context of even simple mistakes by police personnel. It just hasn't taken it that far. And in fact, in Arizona versus Evans, the court expressly noted that it was not reaching that conclusion. So it's really an open question if there was even a simple mistake that led to the issuance of this report, whether that would fall under the good faith exception.
Well, if there was a mistake here, if it was, how would that curb police misconduct?
Well, again, if we assume there was a simple mistake, all right, there's a lot of things we have to think about. What's the procedure that the dispatchers use for looking at these bulletins, and how was a mistake made? Was it that they looked at two different things and they confused it in their mind and it was sort of a simple mistake? Well, I think you can still have deterrence there, because what it's going to do is it's going to deter dispatchers in the future from being careless when they transmit warrant reports. This is different than Arizona versus Evans. There, you have court clerks who have absolutely no relationship in terms of the investigation and interdiction of crime making mistakes. Deterring their conduct, their simple mistakes, has nothing to do with the police. Here, you have a direct link between the mistake and the police department. But I think what's important to remember here is that we don't know what happened in the dispatcher room that day.
Well, did the motion to suppress seek to find that out?
Well, the motion to suppress couldn't have sought to find that out, because at the time the motion was filed, the government was still maintaining that there was a valid arrest warrant. In fact, at the arraignment 3 weeks after Groves was stopped and arrested, they continued at that point to maintain that there is a valid arrest warrant. In fact, not until after the motion to suppress did the government reveal, indeed, there was no warrant, and only then did they raise the May bulletin as an alternative explanation. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Bryan. Mr. Barrett?
May it please the Court, Jesse Barrett for the United States. I'd like to start with the waiver issue, because I think Mr. Groves' brief focuses very, very heavily on the fact that the government did not present the testimony of the 911 dispatcher. And Mr. Groves, though, in the suppression motion, in the arguments following the suppression hearing, and in the briefing following the magistrate judge's report and recommendation recommending denial of that, never raised that question. It was conceded, I think a fair reading of all those documents and of the transcript, that it was the crime information bulletin which led to the mistaken report that there was an outstanding arrest warrant.
If he didn't waive his point, the lack of evidence that first batch was based on the May 1st bulletin, would there be any evidence in the record linking the bulletin?
I think there is, Your Honor.
What would it be?
We have, I think, three discrete facts. The first is Corporal Johnson's testimony that a crime information bulletin is a tool that we use when we need to get information out to the officers in the field, and we provide it to the radio room dispatchers. So we know from his testimony that this crime information bulletin was in the radio room dispatch.
Well, we don't know that. We know that that's what we usually.
We know that it's the standard practice.
Okay, we know it's the standard practice, but we don't. Okay.
You're right. I mean, there was no direct testimony right. that it was sitting at the dispatcher's desk. There was, however, testimony that that's what is done.
Number one.
That's number one. And then number two is the testimony of Corporal McIntyre that he reviewed the files in the South Bend Police Department and that there were no outstanding arrest warrants, no information of any kind of anything outstanding other than the crime information bulletin of May 1st. So we know that the dispatcher had at her disposal that information and no other information. And then the third item is Corporal Slager's testimony on cross-examination. The question from Mr. Gross's counsel was, were you ever informed that you were doing an arrest based on a crime information bulletin? His answer was no. So those are, I think, the three pieces of evidence from the hearing, from testimony that was provided regarding the impact of the crime information bulletin on the dispatcher's actions.
Basis for the self, because that's the focus of Hensley.
What we have is Corporal Johnson's testimony that he received information about the shooting on Bendix Street on the night of April 30th, 2006. He went and he interviewed two eyewitnesses to that shooting. Both eyewitnesses testified that Devon Groves had been on the porch of that house. When he was spotted, Devon Groves ran off to the side of the porch, and instantaneously thereafter, 15 to 20 shots were fired into the house. So we have Corporal Johnson receiving eyewitness information. And then we have Corporal Johnson providing that information to the state court prosecutor, and the state court prosecutor saying, I'm going to seek a warrant. You know, you have verbal authorization to issue this bulletin. So I think under this Seventh Circuit's precedent, not only did Corporal Johnson have reasonable suspicion based on the eyewitness testimony, he had probable cause at that point for issuance of an arrest warrant or for a warrantless arrest, which, of course, with probable cause, the police can do. So if we turn back the clock to the May 1st, 2006, information known to Corporal Johnson at that time and thereafter until Mr. Groves' arrest, he, I think, indisputably had certainly reasonable suspicion, and although Mr. Groves doesn't argue that we needed probable cause, I think he also had probable cause that...
Wait a minute. Are you now arguing that the anonymous had reasonable suspicion?
No.
No, okay.
No, the government does not maintain that. Okay. It all goes back to what Corporal Johnson knew on April 30th and May 1st of 2006.
Okay.
So I don't mean to focus on the waiver point to, you know, demonstrate that we're uncomfortable with the with what the analysis would be on a de novo review. Rather, it's just to point out this is the reason the dispatcher was not called, because there was never any reason to call the dispatcher under the defense's own argument. And not only was there never any reason to call the dispatcher, it was Mr. Groves' position that the crime information bulletin put in motion the events that led to Mr. Groves' arrest on June 1st. As to the good faith exception, first of all, we don't need to reach that if we find that there was the stop and arrest were proper. But as the magistrate judge recommended, as Chief Judge Miller found, there's no evidence of misconduct. There's objectively reasonable reliance by Corporal Slager on the dispatch that he received. There's no indication that he did anything untoward or anything improper. And nor is there any indication that the 911 dispatch center acts in an objectively unreasonable or law-breaking manner. I mean, to the contrary, we have, you know, information, it appears, at the dispatch center, and then a dispatch that went out that didn't exactly match the information in the dispatch center. But there's no indication of anything beyond that of a simple mistake. Unless the court has any questions, I think that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Warren, you have a minute.
I'm trying to quickly address several points that were made. The government maintains that there's three points that link the May bulletin to the dispatch report. First of all, standard practice. Well, it's the standard practice, as well as Corporal Johnson testified, that these bulletins be read and be transmitted to all police personnel. Well, if that's the standard practice, it obviously can fail, because Officer Slager himself testified that he had never heard of nor seen this bulletin. So obviously standard practice isn't a fail-safe method for getting this information throughout the police department. Number two, the government brought up Officer McIntyre's testimony. He said that the only evidence in the South Bend Police Department was this May bulletin. Well, there was also some other police reports related to other investigations about Devon Groves that were brought up at the arraignment hearing that were not mentioned in the argument. In addition, we don't know what information there was in other jurisdictions. If you look at United States versus Hensley, and even before that, the Whiteley decision, those are situations where crime bulletins are coming from other jurisdictions. So it's very possible, very plausible, that information came to the dispatch team from outside of the South Bend jurisdiction. And obviously, a search of the South Bend Police Department records wouldn't have reflected that information.
Warren, I just want to remind you of the time.
Okay, I'll try to finish up this final point. Finally, Officer Slager's testimony. Of course, we concede that he testified that he wasn't told he was acting pursuant to a bulletin. Of course he wasn't. He never heard of the bulletin. He never saw the bulletin. I think in the end, we've got a situation where we know there's a false warrant report. The problem is the government failed to establish where it came from. They have something else, but we don't know that that's what the dispatcher relied on, and that's why we believe the suppression motion should have been granted in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Bourne. Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Mr. Bourne, an additional thanks from the court for your accepting the appointment and so ably representing Mr. Bourne. Court will stand in recess.